Were you taking pictures of my wheelbarrow?
What? No.
Are you the guy that's been saying I'm not allowed to have a wheelbarrow in the office?
No.
Why would anybody care? It never goes outside. It's an inside wheelbarrow. I could understand it if it's an outdoor wheelbarrow. That's dangerous. That's disgusting. But it's not.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 584 for the week of October 13th, 2025. I am Tactical Getaway Shirt David T. Cole, and I'm here with Outdoor Wheelbarrow Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm disgusting.
Unknowing Mall Shopper Tara Ariano.
I think I would know.
And Worst Pillow in Town, Allison Herman.
Made of goddamn metal.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she is a TV critic at Variety. You've heard with us many times before. It's Allison Herman. Welcome back, Allison.
Allison.
Yay!
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Made it here despite many impediments in her way. We're thrilled she's here to join us and talk about The Chair Company, in which Ron Trosper, Tim Robinson, who also created the show with his writing partner, Zach Kanan or Cannon, I'm never sure, has just been named the project lead on a mall development in Canton, Ohio. He had a long hiatus from his job at Fisher Robey to pursue a passion project, but he's back now and maybe not entirely ready for it. For example, he gets agitated when a restaurant server the night before his big day argues with him about whether she's been in a mall recently. They've changed a lot, so she could have been in one and not even known it. Things get worse when he returns to his seat after a kickoff speech and is humiliated in front of the whole company. What could have happened with his chair? Why can't he find the manufacturer's customer service line to complain to? Who would want to keep this information from him and why? And if something nefarious is going on, which seems obvious, how high does it go? The first episode was directed by Andrew DeYoung, also the writer-director of Friendship, the feature film starring Robinson that came out in the spring. Later episodes are directed either by DeYoung or by Aaron Schimberg, who directed last year's A Different Man. Only one episode of The Chair Company has aired so far on HBO. We got access to the first seven, but we'll be careful about spoilers from episodes that have not aired yet. Let's do the Chen check-in. Allison, should our listeners watch The Chair Company?
If they like Tim Robinson.
Sarah?
Yes, but, and that's the reasoning for me.
Okay. Dave.
I'm going to make this a 3 for 3. Exactly. Yes, but.
Yeah, I think people know what their Tim Robinson tolerance level is, and they should act accordingly with that.
Yes.
All right. Allison, you astutely wrote in your review that a person either vibes with this style of comedy, the Tim Robinson style, or not. And you also wrote that you didn't historically, but that this one kind of got you. Explain how.
I think what I have to do as a critic is be like, okay, even if this is not for me, is this like executing the vision and the goals of the people involved with the project? Mm-hmm. And like, frankly, I think with almost all big Tim Robinson projects, the answer is yes. It's just, you know, is this something I would voluntarily be spending my time on if it were not literally my job to do so? Perhaps not. But I think The Chair Company is interesting in the Tim Robinson oeuvre, because it is expanding what has previously been like 2-minute sketches or a contained feature film into a like full 8-episode series of the Tim Robinson experience. Mm-hmm. And the way it does that is that Tim Robinson is playing the Tim Robinson character, which you are probably familiar with if you've seen Friendship or I Think You Should Leave or Detroiters. But so is kind of almost everyone else in the show. And you don't get that classical I Think You Should Leave setup of it's just Tim Robinson or Patty Harrison or Vanessa Bayer acting crazy. It's him acting crazy and then the other person also acting crazy. And then you just slowly start to learn the rules of this crazy world and mm-hmm. you stay there. The whole world is in Tim Robinson's mindset, which is both a lot to take and a very impressive feat of world building and extension.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Sarah, this was your caveat as well.
Yeah, pretty much. This was easier for me to take than some Tim Robinson projects. To my surprise, I mean, I did feel a little squirmy. But Allison, I'm not sure if it was your review where you made a David Lynch comp.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. That's what I thought. I was like struck by that because Tim Robinson historically to me occupies that same sort of cultural part of my brain as David Lynch, which is I think they are doing what they want to do and executing the vision, like you said, but the vision is not something that I choose to spend time with because it sets me on edge. I'm sure that's the point. That's what makes it art, but there's only so many hours, etc. This is more successful in terms of not making me want to like physically turn away from the screen. And I think that there were certain perfectly observed moments, that moment where he's like, this is the worst pillow in town. Like that scene is like 6 seconds long, but it's so economical in like that moment where you're just staring into the dark, uncomfortable, going over this shitty thing that happened to you earlier in the day. There's a moment of like performative water bottle filling where no one's paying attention, but he feels like he has to like do a bit and mm-hmm. then like zip around a corner to investigate something. And it's like so well done. I'm glad this exists. I think it is doing exactly what it's trying to do and it's good. I'm just not sure I'm going to keep going because even though there is a kind of like crazy wall bunt nip aspect to it, like a full half hour of Tim Robinson world is still a full half hour of Tim Robinson world. And I'm just not sure I can take it.
There actually is a crazy wall, but it turns out to be a crazy Excel spreadsheet, which is a hilarious tweak.
That's really funny. He's form. Not using it correct at all.
Not at all.
Just a notes app.
Writing things in, yeah. in boxes.
Yeah. Also, Buntnip, I feel seen.
Two Tim Robinson lovers here and two Tim Robinson tolerators. So, yeah. Dave, what was your take on the show? We watched as many screeners as there were all in a row on Sunday. So what was your feeling?
Well, first of all, I want to say Allison had the perfect way to state whether you're in the Tim Robinson camp or not, which is the cilantro gene.
Yep.
Which is perfect because like it's not up to you and Tim Robinson will taste like soap.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that. It's definitely not for everybody, but it is for me. And I did enjoy this series a lot. I'm sort of the opposite way with this one where I think You Should Leave has these skits that are long and awkward. The one that came to mind is the dog shit office party skit mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. it feels phase from reality. The jokes don't necessarily come fast and furious, but there is a payoff that this feels more like that sort of skit, but it is, of course, much longer. And there's things I enjoyed about every episode, but at the end of it, for me, Tim Robinson is funnier when he's sort of like going a little more a rat-a-tatty. Allison's observation that this is a show that lives in Tim Robinson world instead of being a world with Tim Robinson in it is correct, and that plays into sort of the madness that you feel after a while, mm-hmm. like the heavy friend he eventually makes, you know, the guy that comes along in the first episode and does him some wrong. Mm-hmm. That guy is really weird.
Yeah.
And there are some really great characters in the retail space in this series. There are two, and they both hit it out of the ballpark mm-hmm. in their scenes. So it feels like they've tried to make the whole world be chaos and madness and insanity. Mm-hmm. And it does work on a level, but also without sort of that contrast, that balance, the madness seems normal after a while. I don't know if that makes sense, but the mm-hmm. baseline is different here and it just feels a little off to me.
Yeah. You acclimate. It's like yeah. you're at altitude or something. Yeah. It's like you're there for long enough and then all of a sudden the air starts to feel normal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it also does the I Think You Should Leave thing of making a whole outrage cycle out of something extremely small that is not actually a big deal. But then what changes this from a sketch to a series is that it actually is about something. And that is how maddening it can be in our current economic era when shit does break because it's made to be crappy. And when you try to track down what company made this and it's just a string of consonants that aren't actually a word. I mean, this one is the name is Tekka, which is, you know, closer to something that could be an office furniture brand.
So he's giving an important speech to kick off the project that he's doing, this mall that he's doing. And after he has it, he's really nervous about it. And it goes off. He goes to sit in his chair and it just disintegrates on him. And then he goes on a holy quest to find out what the hell Tekka is building.
Yeah.
And it goes to that. But we're, I don't know if this is a spoiler we can talk about.
Okay.
But I found, I'll cut it if not. But I found as that conspiracy fueled plotline goes along, and there actually is something there, I was a little disappointed about that.
Yeah.
Because I thought the madness was going to be his own and that that would be his journey.
Something that really tickled me about the advance press notes about this show is that it was very vehemently stressed to critics that we should not reveal, quote, details of the chair incident.
Yeah.
The chair incident is that the chair breaks and then he falls. Like,
yes.
That's it. And I just love that it is treating it with the utmost seriousness in the same way that the Tim Robinson character does. But to your point, Dave, like, I think that is what defines this show is like, if this were an I Think You Should Leave sketch, he would go insane and try to contact the customer service and it would turn out to be a total nothing burger and it's just his problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what makes this show and different from other things is that he's onto something.
Mm-hmm.
And we won't reveal the details, but I don't think that's a spoiler because that's the premise of the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another comp I really wanted to make and made in my review is to Nathan Fielder, mm-hmm, who I think is also a cilantro guy also someone who kind of graduated from, in this case, instead of a sketch format, it was more of like a Comedy Central, like pure comedy reality show, and then goes to HBO, gets the backup and the resources and the patience to really do something big with The Rehearsal. But I think the reason I click with Nathan Fielder in a way I don't with Tim Robinson is Nathan Fielder is a lot wordier, frankly. Like, the way his character on screen processes his social anxiety is talking through it and obsessively recreating it and being very detailed and precise in the way that he explains what's going on with him.
Mm-hmm.
One of the commonality points, I think, between Tim Robinson and David Lynch is they both do not like to talk about their work. They do not like to talk about their process, and things express themselves in this like inchoate, inarticulate way that's often literally just people like screaming. But the specific way they scream just channels some like existential overwhelm that a lot of people can relate to. And, you know, in my most abrasive moments with the Tim Robinson experience, I'm like, is this just a guy like yelling and making faces? But you could say the same thing about like Diane Ladd and Wild at Heart.
Right.
But like, I think about that all the time.
And I have said that.
Yes.
Actually.
Yeah. And there is there's something too deeper on the level of like, this is one thing, what the show is on the surface about is something that everyone across like the whole political spectrum, I think, can agree on, which is like, shit is getting shittier and we are like desperate to try to correct the wrongs we can because the bigger ones are too big. And I feel like maybe that's not what Tim Robinson would say the show is about, but that's what I got out of it anyway. Other than Tim Robinson, there are probably two actors in this that you recognize, Lou Diamond Phillips and Lake Bell. Phillips doesn't have a ton to do. He's sort of a tertiary character. He drops in and out. But how did everyone think Lake Bell fit in as a Mrs. Tim Robinson, which as of this year is a sorority that includes Cecily Strong, Kate Mara, others? Allison, what are your thoughts?
Well, I thought it was great that you brought up the across the political spectrum thing, because I think the relationship between Tim Robinson's character and Lake Bell's character is the most potentially political thing in the show, which is that her character has started a small business that, to the show's credit, it takes entirely seriously. She's like redesigned a breast pump and she has this business. She's trying to bring it to market. If anyone on the show is like the straight woman or the straight man, it's her.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim Robinson had a similar venture that did not go as well. And he's now returned to his sort of wage slavery real estate development job. And I think something that a lot of people have said about Tim Robinson's comedy when they're trying to intellectualize it is that it's about, you know, the male loneliness crisis, the way men are kind of adrift and left behind and don't know what to do. And I think the fact that this show is about a man who is less successful professionally than his wife and is trying to process that and trying to figure out what his identity is and what his place in the world. And he's trying to pursue some sense of power and agency through this conspiracy rabbit hole he goes down. That, I think, is the most, like, you could project a sort of modern political conundrum onto it. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it's not, like, outright talking about Jordan Peterson or right. MRAs or anything. It's coded into it.
Yeah.
And, like, Belle, I think, is very key to that aspect of the show.
Mm-hmm. And that it gives another arena of awkwardness for Ron as well, because like she has professional events that she has to do as she's trying to get this business to work, and it's new people for him to meet and be weird around.
Right. But he's also like less professionally successful than like his kid who's being like recruited for D1 schools, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's definitely, I agree that that's like a comment on the male loneliness crisis, but it's sort of like not necessarily coming down anywhere about it. It's just like, this exists. Here's one exemplar. Mm-hmm. But I also appreciated that, like, sometimes what I can't deal with cringe comedy or like, you know, squirmity is that the reaction of the surrounding world and people does not seem proportionate. And I sort of appreciated having a Tim Robinson character who had like normie, neurotypical people and a family and sort of like average non-screaming concerns that grounded things in a way that sometimes his work just feels like completely unmoored from everything, including like verbalization, like mm-hmm. Allison said. So I felt like Lake Bell's character and like the conception of their family and everyone else in its relationship to Ron was like really smart to just be like, you know, he has a beautiful wife and beautiful kids and they're smart and, you know, achieved, and they think he's pretty normal and they're proud of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say the other character or the other actor you might recognize, or at least I recognized, is Sophia Lillis, aka mm-hmm. Baby Amy Adams from Sharp Objects,
yep.
as the daughter. And I actually really liked that relationship as mm-hmm. the show continues, because I don't think this is a spoiler, but as the plot about the chair develops, she becomes a character who Tim Robinson voices his concerns to and is like, hey, here's what's going on in my life. And she plays a really interesting mix of like some skepticism and, hey, I'm worried about you, but she also takes him very seriously and is mm-hmm. like, wow, like this is crazy. Like, look at what you found. And I thought that really crystallized his family, you know, has some reaction that a normal person would of like, hey, you're acting weird, but also mm-hmm. is like, this is someone I love and respect and admire in some ways. And it does a lot to like establish the baseline.
Yeah. And we get more perspective on her character when we meet her fiance, because it sort of gives us a perspective of why she is very tolerant of weird people and how that has followed her into her own adult relationships, too. Because her fiance, whose name is unfortunately Tara, is a real piece of work. I'll just say that because we don't see her until later.
There's like a trend that I'm seeing of like actual sort of realistic, not like weird father-daughter mm-hmm. puzzle-solving mm-hmm. relationships in prestige TV. I mean, two is not a trend, and this daughter is not an adult in the lowdown, but I am feeling lately like when a sort of semi-grown or grown woman child is introduced into these plots lately, like it's being written by someone who, you know, actually had a father. It's like, mm-hmm. hey, thank you. This feels a lot more normal and less weird and Walt than it has in the past.
Got a lot of shows. It's a great time for shows.
It is time to go around the dial talking about TV we've been watching recently. First up, Tara.
Yeah, last week we got the series premiere of the newest 911 show, which is 911 Nashville. And if all you know about Nashville is country music and bachelorette parties, I have bad news, which is they already used up both of those in the first episode. I've talked in the past about how annoying I find the one season of Law & Order where each of the regular characters had a season arc story, like Briscoe's daughter getting murdered, sorry. My issue is that this is not what we come to regular Law & Order for. I had a similar problem with the first episode of 911 Nashville. So the main firefighter characters are Don and Ryan Hart, father and son, respectively played by Chris O'Donnell and the kid from The Holdovers who got left at school for the holidays because he refused to cut his hair, that guy. Don and Ryan also rodeo together and by all indications love each other and are very close. But then they have a run-in with a firefighter stripper named Blue, who's played by Hunter McVeigh.
Whose professional name is?
Captain Smoke Show. Mm-hmm. Is that it? Okay. Ryan finds out Blue is Don's estranged son from an affair he had. Don has known about Blue his whole life, but Blue's awful mother, Dixie, who's played by Leanne Rimes, has kept Don from seeing Blue until he was of age, but did take the Hart's money that whole time. And before you're like, firefighter money? Don's wife, Blythe, who's played by Jessica Capshaw, is a rich horse breeder or something, and she and Don reconciled after their brief separation. She's known about Blue this whole time, too. Ryan's all upset because Don, both parents actually, do a terrible job breaking the news to him about his half-brother, and Don then also gives Blue a special training exception so he can become a firefighter and learn on the job, even though he says he's making three times the starting salary of a firefighter stripping, which they say is $60,000 for a firefighter. So, like, you're making close to 200 grand a year stripping. What are you doing? These are your prime stripping years. But anyway.
Guess there is sex in the champagne room. Good job.
So this would let him learn on the firefighter job. But then it seems like Ryan's getting over himself and accepting Blue. And then we see his awful mother, Dixie, and find out she's been lying to Blue his whole life about Don rejecting him and hatched this whole scheme to get him to sink his claws into the Hearts so Don will give him money to give Dixie so she can have polyp surgery on her throat and revive her country singing career. This is so convoluted. I didn't even mention the part where Blue chanced to find Don by doing 23andMe, but also B, they already did a surprise son reveal on 911 Lone Star, and C, this is not what we come to the 911 franchise for and not what it ever delivers. No two characters in the regular cast are allowed to be in conflict for more than four episodes, even like enemies, which means either they're breaking the format for Dixie or they're going to redeem her probably by having her get in some kind of weird accident and get saved by Blythe, the horse breeder, for some reason. And that's how she becomes a good person and they give her the polyp money anyway. I'm already mad. Unfortunately, I will be watching every episode, though.
But I think she's going to almost drown in a vat of hot sauce for hot Nashville chicken.
That's very possible. All of that said, the real magic was in the main show. I wish I'd known that and not watched it first. In the season 9 premiere of 911, there's another loose yet flattering fictionalization of Elon Musk, which every show and movie has to do. This one's played by Mark Consuelos. He's out kayaking when he zooms in for a meeting with his board and his crisis manager about all the bad press he's been getting lately. And then he gets swallowed whole by a humpback whale. Right before it cuts to commercial, the whale spits out the kayak and the paddle, I think. And then after the commercial, we see this guy has not lost connection to the board because he's on a satellite phone. So he's zooming in from inside a whale's mouth or possibly throat. The 118 rescue him, doesn't matter how. And then fake Elon is so grateful. He decides to try to get some good press by giving Hen, Aisha Hines, the firefighter who revived him, a free trip to space. She finagles a plus one, assuming her wife, Karen, played by Tracy Toms, who is a literal rocket scientist at JPL. But Karen says she's not going because her lab is in the middle of several lawsuits against fake Elon and not, for example, we have two children. So in case something happens, we probably shouldn't both go into space together. But then all of the guys of the 118 start kissing up to Hen, so she'll bring one of them. But then she's talking to Athena, played by Angela Bassett, who had withdrawn from social life since her husband Bobby, Peter Krause, died last season, but then she answered a wellness check on a woman who had just about died from fasciating necrotitis because she'd been a severely depressed agoraphobe, and it was a real wake-up call to Athena to get back to life and accept the next invitation she gets, and that's when Hen decides to take her to space, and that's where the season premiere leaves us in space. Sidebar, and I already complained about this on Blue Sky, most shows that didn't have real cast members really die while the show was still on have not gone on about how much a character's death has changed the lives of everyone who loved them, like 911 has about Bobby for like 20 episodes so far. Peter Krause could be written in the show as Bobby's identical cousin next week. He is still alive. Everyone can stop mourning him. He's fine. But anyway, 911 rules. I'm very happy to have 911 back. It's ridiculous.
Peter who?
Krause.
Thank you. All right. Very good. And to plug?
Yeah, for my plug, I'm going to be recapping Murdaugh, Death in the Family, the new Hulu true crime show. Those are going to be at Decider starting October 15th. The day this episode comes out, we will link my author page in the show notes because the first one hasn't gone up yet.
All right, Allison, what do you got for us?
I cheated and did the show that I'm currently reviewing for Variety,
which
you can read later this week. And that show is Devil in Disguise, John Wayne Gacy, which is Peacock's very transparent attempt to have its own monster down to the famous serial killer's name. Obviously, the first season is focusing on John Wayne Gacy, who is infamous to most people as kind of the archetypal killer clown. But I found this take on him really interesting in that it fits into a trend that I would call anti-true crime, that are these shows that are true crime narratives, but build in a kind of structural critique of the genre. One show I name check in the review is The Investigation, which is a Scandinavian show where it's about the investigation into the death of the journalist Kim Wall, who is Swedish. And among many very pointed choices that show made is that it only ever refers to the killer as the accused. He's never named. It's not about him. It's about who this woman was and how they catch the killer. And Devil in Disguise, John Wayne Gacy fits into an even more specific subgenre of that, which are true crime stories that are specifically about gay men and how we don't care, or law enforcement and its society does not care about their safety, often allowed killers to act with impunity because the victims were not considered actually innocent in their own right, though of course they were. I would say the assassination of Gianni Versace fits into that.
Last Call.
Yes, the excellent actual true crime documentary Last Call is very much in that vein. And this show is, its way into the Gacy case is that it starts with the disappearance of his very last victim, a Chicago area teen boy named Rob Peast. And it becomes about how law enforcement very quickly found Gacy after that happened. And then even though they found him in 10 days, they then found dozens of bodies in the crawl space under his house. And the whole show becomes about how did this happen? How was he allowed to operate for this long? Every episode includes flashbacks that are kind of a portrait in miniature of various victims who, some of them are sex workers, some of them were juvenile delinquents, some of them were just young kids who just didn't have a lot of connection or protection and were enticed by the idea of being able to work for money. And I don't think this show is perfect. For one thing, I think it's way too long. There's a psychologist who gives a full brief of here's what John Wayne Gacy's deal is in episode 3. And it keeps going from that point. But I did find it very moving, very tasteful, very thoughtful and considered about how it's going to take this case that everyone has an idea of and really anchors it in the reality and trauma and loss of these victims. And also excises a lot of stuff that you would expect to see from a John Wayne Gacy show. For example, you never see him full on in the clown getup. You see the clown paintings in his house. You see one shot of him from behind, very late in the series. But you don't see that. You don't really see him actually kill people. There's no orgy of blood that you might expect in certain other Ryan Murphy shows. I think Monster Dahmer is the obvious comparison point here. And that show had a lot of those themes, but then also was kind of and let's show some of the completely disgusting stuff because let's be real, that's what you're here for. And I think this show restrains from that, which I think may limit its broad appeal, but is a very, again, intentional way to approach this that I think makes its point very effectively. So that's John Wayne Gacy, Devil in Disguise, John Wayne Gacy on Peacock.
Peacock also did John Wayne Gacy, Devil in Disguise, which was the documentary version of this. Full disclosure, a friend and colleague of mine was the producer on that. And I think the projects are related. I had a similar reaction to the documentary in that I actually learned a lot of things I didn't know, and that it was interrogating how did we get here and not being killer clown. Ooh. So if it's sort of in the same ecosystem of narrative, that's a recommendation for it for sure.
I mean, the fact that they cast Michael Chernus as John Wayne Gacy says a lot about the quality of the project, I would say.
He's excellent. Yeah.
He's great, always.
Really, really hits the right tone. Well cast, well performed. Two thumbs up for him.
And what would you like to plug? We'll link to your author page at Variety, but anything else?
You know, I think that's basically it. We are entering into the funnel of the fall TV release season, which I don't need to tell anyone on the Zoom, but it means that I will be working quite prolifically on reviews for the next like month or so. Mm-hmm. So you can find me over at Variety.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I regret to say that we are stuck in the true crime quadrant. I'll try to make it quick. The latest documentary from Jinx directors and producers Andrew Jarecki and Charlie Kaufman, The Alabama Solution, came out a few days ago. First of all, it's a two-hour feature. Thank God. It is about the wretched conditions in and slave labor leveraged by the Alabama prison system and the way incarcerated men tried to band together to get the word out, organize labor actions at Al. It's very good. It's not quite great, but it's very good. I do recommend it. It is on HBO/HBO Max. The directors chose the protagonists wisely. They follow, among others, Robert Earl, Kinetic Justice Counsel, and Melvin Ray. They are both experts at organizing and conveying intel about life behind bars. They know the difference between educational and actionable. There's a pointed lack of judgment about or focus on why various subjects in this documentary got incarcerated. I think that that is the correct play. There is one incarcerated man who is allegedly, I suppose we must say, murdered by a CO. His mother is like fighting upstream to try to get justice for him. At one point, she's speaking to just people in her community about what happened. And this man is like, what did he do to get locked up? And then he asks whether Stephen was into dope and alcohol. I swear to God, this is not a cheap shot at Alabama accents. This is actually how he pronounces the word. But that scene and sort of audio of a range of smug talk radio commentary, all what they expect, it's jail, while you're watching raw sewage float down a hallway as filmed by incarcerated person with a contraband cell phone, it does strike a good balance. It's not really trying to get into judgments. It's just repeating like, these are human rights violations and they've been going on for a long time and continue. I think it has some pacing problems kind of in the middle because there are so many like lanes and side streets to this story. But I think it also speaks well of the Alabama Solution that there were like three other documentaries that could have been made and like nested inside this one. That is like, it's like just do one about how many times they transferred Kinetic Justice to try to shut him up and how it just has been failing for like 25 years. I would watch that. I would watch a three-parter on that. But this one, as made, is very good. That's The Alabama Solution. It is on HBO Max. I reviewed it in a fuller fashion on Best Evidence. You can find that at bestevidence.fyi. And I have every possible take on carceral life going back 120 years at my true crime bookshop. That's exhibitbbooks.com. If you need a recommendation, hit the chat button. I am happy to help, and we will link all of that in the show notes.
All right, here's what's coming up on Extra Extra Hot Great. This Friday, we're going to be talking about the new sitcom DMV that is available to club members. If you're not a club member, you can go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join and get that and 10,000 other episodes waiting for you in the archives. And then come back here next week. EHG Prime will be talking about Boston Blue with Margaret H. Willison.
Boston Zone.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week, it's Tara Ariano.
Hello. One of the biggest TV debuts this year was The Studio, the comedy that swept the Emmys and rivaled Severance for Apple TV No More Plus, I guess. This is the buzziest show. But what if I told you it's not the best comedy on the platform and is, in fact, not even the platform's best Seth Rogen comedy? That honor belongs to Platonic. I will die on this hill. But first, I'm going to pitch you Season 1, Episode 5, titled My Wife's Boyfriend. Here is why it belongs in the canon. Number one, it gives us the most Charlie we've seen to date, and the time spent with him is a pleasure. The titular friends of Platonic are Sylvia, Rose Byrne, and Will, Seth Rogen, close college friends who were estranged during his marriage to someone Sylvia didn't like. In the series premiere, Sylvia sees an Instagram post that Will is divorced, and she and Will reconnect. But this is no ordinary middle-aged friendship. Will and Sylvia have a tendency to egg each other on into crazy schemes they might never attempt on their own. In the course of the first three episodes, this includes antagonizing a pawn shop guard dog, pulling off a heist of Will's bearded lizard from his ex-wife's house, and getting sufficiently day drunk that Sylvia antagonizes her husband's boss at a law partner's retreat because, oh yeah, Sylvia's getting up to these hijinks, despite being a happily married mother of three. Many who have been in committed monogamous partnerships might wonder what Sylvia's husband thinks about her hanging out so much with a guy who is both straight and available, and this episode, the show finally gives that guy a chance to say, Charlie, Sylvia's husband, played by Luke McFarlane, comes home from work to find Will in the kitchen with Sylvia. She is in the middle of bleaching Will's hair. When she asked Will earlier if he was doing it because of a girl, he shrugs her off, which becomes important later. With Charlie, Will and Sylvia both act as if there's nothing remarkable about her fondling his head in front of her husband, but Charlie does and brings it up to Sylvia in bed later. Clip one.
Oh, I mean, come on, you're fondling a grown man's hair in our kitchen.
What's wrong with a woman giving her friend a makeover?
It's just a little bit intimate, don't you think? I mean, he wasn't wearing a shirt, so...
She was wearing a trash bag. Babe, you knew I love makeovers when you married me.
Yeah, I mean, if that were true, how come you've never given me a makeover?
Because you don't need one. Because you're not having a midlife crisis, thank God. Because you're just perfect the way you are. Mm. You're so cute.
Okay. Well, our Honda Odyssey is perfect just the way it is, and they still add new features every year.
What's going on?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's nothing. It just seemed like you guys were having so much fun.
That's hard work. You know what's fun is 8 hours of sleep.
Okay.
Charlie has known Will and Sylvia long enough not to worry that there is, ever has been, or ever probably could be any sexual spark between Sylvia and Will. Charlie's concern, as he explains the next day at work to his colleague Stuart, Guy Branum, is that there's a specific kind of fun Sylvia has with Will that she doesn't have with Charlie. Clip two.
I just forgot how annoying the two of them can be together. It's like their friendship excludes everybody, including me.
Look, everyone needs friendships outside of their marriage. No one can get everything they need from just one person. And just because she likes hanging around with this guy occasionally doesn't mean she doesn't love you.
Yeah, and for the record, I know it's not like they're having an affair. It's not like Sylvia's cheating on me.
No, Sylvia would never. There's just this little frisson between the two of them where they get dressed up in costumes and flirt with each other. It's perfectly normal. Everyone does it. We're doing it right now.
We are?
Yeah, except I would never have sex with you. You're my Mary. Vanessa, interestingly, is my fuck.
And Albert's your kill.
Obviously.
And just to be clear, I know that Will and Sylvia are not fucking, but it almost feels like they're getting off on the fact that they could be fucking.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, and I'm not allowed to say anything because if I do, it makes me seem square, like that my brain would even go to that place.
I'm just worried that you're having one of those brain glitches where you get obsessed with something, like a Roomba stuck in a corner.
But they could be fucking, and her knowing that I know that they could be fucking, but I can't say anything, that is so fucked.
Roomba.
Yeah. You know what? Maybe it's my fault that I feel so excluded. I've never really made an effort with Will.
Just let it go.
Maybe I should invite him to the Dodgers game tomorrow.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. It's a company event.
Yeah, I mean, how fun would that be? Just hanging out together.
Am I in this room? Can you hear me?
Charlie does, in fact, invite Will to the game. And since Sylvia is too chicken to talk to Charlie about it, Charlie and Will do go, which is when we see how Charlie metabolizes a socially awkward situation with extreme extroversion. He welcomes Will so effusively that he knocks down a stranger. He forces Will to eat a Dodger dog Lady and the Tramp style for multiple photo setups that take several excruciating minutes. It's around this time that Will finds out he has long been a topic of conversation among the strangers he is only now meeting. Clip three.
Man, Lucky Penny? Dude, I've been there. It's a cool place.
Thank you.
Hey, Charlie, you didn't tell us your wife's boyfriend owns Lucky Penny.
His what now?
Your wife's boyfriend. That's what we call
not
him.
Bad.
No, I never.
Number five.
But Charlie almost immediately brings up the boyfriend joke when he and Will go for an insanely long pee, apologizing for his colleagues. Charlie also admits that his own tendency to overthink things, which he advises Will not to do in his new relationship with the much younger Peyton, played by Emily Kimball, is part of what made him invite Will to the game in the first place. Will and Sylvia are the kind of people who discuss Charlie behind his back. Charlie is the kind of mature, confident adult who also does that with Stuart, but won't take too long to address situations head on. Or to put it another way, clip four.
You know, you're a stable dick.
Number two, it shows us Charlie has the capacity to be more than a stable dick. Is Charlie the kind of guy who would ever suggest flinging electric scooters across a street or bowl with empty beer kegs to knock them down? Probably not, but if someone else, like Will, suggests it, Charlie is happy to join in. And by the way, even with a beer keg, Charlie's bowling form is top-notch. These feats of skill and strength kick off a montage of Lucky Penny patrons and staff showing off their secret skills! Secret skills! Charlie sings a soulful a cappella Danny Boy. Stuart volunteers to name all the prime numbers to 1,000. Sylvia, drawn to the brewery after a text from Charlie, announces that Will can do the dance from Coyote Ugly. And not only does he do it, he also teaches it to Charlie. Sidebar. When I interviewed Luke McFarlane during the first season, he said that was originally supposed to be like drink choreography from Cocktail, but that Rogan can do it. So they switched to the dance. I feel it important to note that Sylvia's terrible attempt at breakdancing predates Australian athlete Ray Gunn's appearance at the Olympics by more than a year. Did she get that idea from Sylvia? Probably not, but it's funny to think so. There is more, like Omar's 30-second rhinoceros, pretty good. But the point is, Charlie is not a joyless scold, keeping Sylvia from acting a fool so that she needs Will as an outlet. Get a few craft beers in him and Charlie can be a fool as well. Number three, it confirms that on a fundamental level, Charlie is a stable dick. After the secret skills exhibition, Charlie offhandedly mentions Peyton, which he soon finds out is the first Sylvia has ever heard of her. Offended that she is outside the circle on this one, Sylvia picks a passive-aggressive argument about why Will didn't mention Peyton when Sylvia specifically asked about his possible new love interests earlier. And Stuart's suggestion that they subject the matter to barbitration doesn't lead either friend to be their best selves. Clip five.
My complaint is that my friend lied to me and told everybody else at this bar that he had a girlfriend because he's a giant weirdo.
Well, why do you care?
Well, because it's weird.
I did not tell everybody that I have a girlfriend.
Oh, okay. Everybody raise your hand if you knew Will had a girlfriend Friday. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
I was there the night they met. They had a magical connection.
So, as my closing argument, I would like to ask the defendant why he could lie to my face about something that he felt so freely be able to share with a complete stranger, such as my husband.
I have known Will for 15 years.
Objection overruled.
You're not the judge. Also, there is no judge in
an
arbitration.
It's a arbitration.
I was forced to confirm the existence of my alleged girlfriend to the plaintiff's husband when I confirmed that the plaintiff's husband was telling everyone at his work that I was your boyfriend.
Oh, shit.
The argument ranges into the revelation to Charlie that Sylvia and Will just did ketamine by mistake, thinking it was cocaine, at Will's divorce party in the previous episode. But throughout said argument, it's been clear that Charlie is sobering up and preparing to handle the situation. And it's at this point that he and Sylvia get up to leave. That's when Will trips behind the bar and comes back up with a large shard of broken glass sticking out of his arm. Will immediately starts panicking and yelling about what he should do. Charlie correctly tells him not to pull it out, but Will just yells that he's going to and immediately starts gushing blood, swooning when he sees how bad it looks. Just one person in the bar is capable of rising to the occasion, and that person is Charlie the Stable Dick, telling Sylvia to call 911, sending Omar for clean towels, and finally ripping off his tailored Dodgers shirt to make a tourniquet. Sylvia is moved and maybe a little horny, and when she and Charlie get home, she's able to access a little of Charlie's adult competence to have a mature conversation that reasserts their joint stability. Clip six.
I'm so sorry, babe. I'm sorry I didn't tell you about the ketamine. It was a complete mistake. I should never even try the coke.
I know. It's... I get it. I remember this kind of night from when we first met. You were so wild back then. It was one of the parts of you I fell in love with. I love our family. I love our kids. I love this tiny house, but if I'm being honest, I miss that side of you, and I hope that I didn't take it away.
What? No, you didn't take anything away. You're the best thing that ever happened to me.
I know it sounds kind of stupid, but I've been feeling kind of cut out.
I'm sorry that I ever made you feel cut out. That's my fault. It won't happen again.
Okay.
Big kiss.
No. That's not what we're doing tonight.
What they are doing, as we see when Charlie's back in his office, is frosting Charlie's tips. Clip 7.
It made sense in the moment.
What moment?
One assumes this last remnant of the wildest night Charlie's probably had all decade has only reaffirmed his commitment to stable dickhood. My wife's boyfriend lets the two leads take a break from their joint mayhem to give the spotlight to a character we sense rarely seeks it. The result teaches us a lot about all three of them and deftly sets up the new mayhem yet to come in the back half of the season and in season two, with him especially. But it also stands alone as a hilarious look at the trio's unique dynamic that I think definitely belongs in the canon.
Thank you, Tara. Allison, do you want to take first crack at the canon presentation and the show itself?
Sure. So spoiler alert, I'm just going to be a bit of a party pooper here. I reviewed Platonic when it first came out and did not love it. And I was eager to get the opportunity to revisit it, especially because a lot of people in my life who I know and trust really liked the second season that came out this year. And my understanding is that part of what makes the second season an improvement is that it sort of ditches the premise of the show, which is the belaboring the old When Harry Met Sally question of how men and women can be, per the title, platonic friends. And my beef with the show from the beginning has always been that it like acknowledges upfront that the premise is kind of silly and facile and thin, and yet still tries to commit to it. And I think this episode was sort of an example of that, in that I just never really invest emotionally in a question that I think has kind of been asked and answered already. And then another issue I've always had with the show that I actually weirdly found revisiting this episode quite elucidating in figuring out is that it's always had a kind of forced fun feeling to me, in that I always get the feeling that I am supposed to find Will and Sylvia's whole dynamic really charming, and I never have. And that dynamic is really crystallized to me by this show feels like, to me, going to the work event of your friend's husband you kind of don't know. It's like, I know this is supposed to be like a recreational bonding activity, but I feel completely outside it. And the whole premise from the jump, i.e. that you should like be friends with your coworkers, is already a little skewed, or at least if it doesn't happen naturally. And so, yeah, like, I think this show is very much a platonic episode, and the episode is platonic and what it wants to be. But I have just never agreed with or vibed with that. And, you know, down to the something I also really great at in sitcoms like this is when you can tell they're really trying to make a bit happen and make it something that either recurs throughout the series or lives outside of the series. Secret Skills being one of them. But I remember in like the recent sitcom Adults, there's a whole thing about, you know, certain roommate rituals that they're clearly trying to make a thing. And it's sort of the cart leading the horse of, if I don't have the buy-in of that social group and its organic chemistry, then I'm also not going to find their little quirky things that they do in customs particularly transferable to my own life or a useful framework with which to approach the world. And so I did appreciate the opportunity to look back on this, but I did find myself kind of right back where I was when I first watched this a couple years ago, which is not really on the train.
All right. Thank you, Allison. Before we move on to Sarah, I just want to ask, where are you with Seth Rogen? Because he is another cilantro actor for a lot of people.
I love him, and I love the studio, and I love a lot of people on the show, including Rose Byrne. As a San Diego native, I was kind of a defender of Physical, her other Apple show. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I also do think a real factor in my response to the show is that it's very much an LA show. And so you get that like narcissism of small differences where I'm like, that's not how that works. Or like, I know those kinds of people in real life and I think they're annoying, right up to like starting with they're going to the Yeasty Boys truck, which is like a very annoyingly overhyped bagel truck that is not relevant to 99% of the people who are listening to this. But like, I pick up on those details and kind of grate at them. But I love Seth Rogen overall. It's just not my favorite use of him.
Yeah. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, you take next crack.
Seth Rogen, to me, is like LA version of my younger brother. Like, not exactly a physical match, but like the vibe is very similar. The only difference is like my brother thinks I'm pretty funny, and I don't think Seth Rogen characters would like laugh at any of my jokes at all. And this particular Seth Rogen character seems like a kind of a trial. But with that said, there were so many parts of this episode that I thought, like, Platonic is a weird prospect for me because I feel like the main characters are actually both kind of assholes and you want them to, like, renew their friendship and go somewhere else so you can spend more time with the secondary characters. That's kind of how I felt. Like, the conversation about the, you know, the Roomba, and this is, like, you're obsessing about this, and then he appears in that, like, perfectly tailored Dodger shirt. The thing with the Dodger dog harassment, like, it's just a fucking hot dog. I don't know what it is with Dodger fans and the Dodger dog. Like, it is a hot dog. Get over it. Allison's point about they're trying to, like, make this secret skills fetch happen, maybe, is well taken. But I really enjoyed that part of the episode and the way that it evoked that, like, you've been drinking all day, now it's dark outside, and you're really on that knife edge of, like, this could be a legendary day, like, mega day, as we say on Again With This, that, you know, you'll talk about for decades, or it could all just go horribly wrong. And then it kind of does both. But evoking that, I thought, was, like, just really well done. And, like, the way that everyone is standing around nodding sagely when the guy is trying to demonstrate how he could suck his own dick made me laugh. Guy Branum, I would watch, like, a whole show about that character. Honestly, he's just, like, perfect. And, you know, they never feel the need to explain what he's about. You just get it. Yeah, this was a pleasure. But there is, I mean, Allison's point, like I said, is well taken. Like, there is kind of a, like, foundationally off-putting thing about this show that, like, every time I watch it, I laugh. I'm happy to have watched it. And then I'm like, is this flawed in its inception because these two performers that I really like them both, but their characters here are just, like, it's the friends of friends that you hang out with separately once. And then you're like, yeah, I think we're all set. So, yeah, I don't know how I'm going to vote. I'm interested to see what Dave says. Dave.
I don't think we're supposed to think that their lead characters have, like, an inherently quirky and enjoyable and likable relationship. I think they are supposed to be two jerks that are together and having a lot of problems. They just happen to find each other at this moment in their lives. Mm. Your San Diego pride explains why there's dozens of empty Jamba Juice cups behind you in the Zoom. Which, by the way, clean your room.
Be clear, that's a joke.
Speaking to the LA of it all, one of the other things I noticed, because it was very close to where we lived in LA, was the Jet Rag, you know, secondhand store. That place would often have lineups like that out the door when I was just walking up and down. It's on La Brea near Beverly. And so that was, like, one thing they did get right about LA here. A lot of little things about this episode I did like. One thing I want to bring to the table, though, is Will has a giant banana phone in the second season. Sorry, banana phone case for his iPhone. And in the season, he also has something large and chunky. Are giant novelty phone cases signs of an unwell mind?
I think in his case, it's a sign of arrested development because he's supposed to be chasing his youth, even though he's in his 40s.
Because if I see somebody with something like that, I'm a little wary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I might get my heckles up. Yeah. I felt seen with the get it right photographer trying to get the picture of the Dodger dog in the moment where he's got to change the lens. No, wait, the F-stop's not right. That's always a bummer when you're not ready to get that moment. But for me, this episode comes down to, like, the secret skill scene. I think that is the key piece for this episode. That is what is on the marquee. And everything else around it, I'm like, okay, it's fine. There's little things here and there I like. The little part after the secret skills where Will pulls out the shard, he starts bleeding out, and he just sort of, like, absentmindedly says, oh, that's yucky. That's my favorite joke in the episode for some reason.
But it did, if I may interrupt, it reminded me of the time that we were bowling with, I won't say his whole government name, I won't out him, but even though this is a complimentary story, but we were with Josh W., and a kid was farting around in the bowling alley and, like, got a ball bowled into his hand and, like, got crushed, and we were all panicked, and Josh was the only one who knew, like, who just sprang into action and handled the situation. And this scene reminded me of that actual moment for our lives.
Beer, like, Josh?
Beer Josh, yes.
Yeah, oh, Beer Josh.
Anyway.
He knows what's up.
So I think for me this episode, I might have just excised secret skills and tried to put that in the tiny canon. Everything around it I thought was okay, but maybe not elevated to canon worthiness. Although there are jokes I like referring to Machine Gun Kelly as looks like a dead body with tattoos. was like kind of a perfect piece of writing. Let's put this to the official vote. Allison, I think I know what you're going to say, but let's make this official.
Yes, I laid my cards on the table, but I am a nay.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm going to rule in favor of the plaintiff and say yay.
All right. I'm going to say nay. And I thought this was going to go. I lost $4,000 on this one. So, unfortunately, that means Platonic Season 1, Episode 5, My Wife's Boyfriend. You are hereby not inducted into the Extra Hot Gray Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
All right, we got to make this quick. We are over budget. Who is our winner of the week, Tara?
Our winner of the week is HBO, which got the rights to air a special taped version of Julio Torres's recent off-Broadway show, Color Theories. I do not live in New York anymore, so I was sad to have missed this one and was really happy that it got filmed so that I can experience it. Excited to see it. He's one of my favorites. And if you haven't already watched his first special, My Favorite Shapes, which is also on HBO, you should do that. He is a genius.
Thank you, Tara. And loser of the week, Sarah.
Yellow Jackets. It is ending with season 4 instead of after season 1 like it should have, or season 2 like it also could have. Wasn't the initial plan, quote unquote, for it to be 5 seasons? And
probably.
They're like, we have a plan for all 5. And then it became evident, like season 2, episode 3, that it's like, oh, you didn't have a plan.
They had a plan to make money for 5 years off the show, I think was the plan. Yeah.
Okay, well, plan failed. Uh-huh. Anyway, Yellow Jackets, strong start, but this is, you know, sometimes dead is better, as they say.
Well, Sarah D. Bunting, speaking about dead being better, do you know what time it is?
It's got to be game time.
Game time. Welcome back to Game Time. This is the 8th of the season. Our scores are bewilderingly Tara with 3.5 points, Sarah with 1.5 points, Value Guess with 2 points. Today we are playing 30 Under 30 Part 2, our follow-up from last week. It comes from Mike Seifert. Once again, we have a list of 21 actors. For each one, your goal is to name a TV series in which that actor has appeared in under 30 episodes. For each actor, all three of our contestants will in turn name a show they think fits the bill. Best answer, meaning the show for which the actor has the most IMDb credits without going over 30, is always worth 5 points. And then as we go down, there's different buckets for 3, 2, and 1 point. These are Price is Right rules, so if you go over, no points. To keep the list of possible answers manageable, accepted answers do not include shows where the actor only has one credit. Voice acting, anything classified as a miniseries. Here is an example. We did it last week, but just to refresh your memory, I am going to give you the actor Jared Harris. Allison, why don't you give me a show Jared Harris was in closest to 30 episodes without hitting 30 or over? What do you think here?
Can I reveal that we did this demo before the recording started?
Absolutely not.
In fact, I could give the exact accurate answer, but I will instead recapitulate my wrong answer from before so everyone can learn from my mistake. And I said Mad Men.
Yes, Mad Men, unfortunately, is over 30. It was in 35 episodes of that. But let us know what the actual best answer is here, please. Can you remember?
The actual best answer that I have struggled to retain in my head because I've already forgotten it. Like so many. This show does not exist and will never exist, but it is Foundation.
Yes.
Foundation. TV.
The best possible answer is in 29 episodes of that. And I was also saying before the show that Foundation is just a set of key art we see on the Apple TV non-plus home screen. And that's all it is. It's not a real TV show.
Amazing.
All right. That's how you play. Let's figure out our order today.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Our order today is going to be Tara, Sarah, and then Allison. Are we ready to play 30 Under 30 Part 2?
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Tara, you will start the guessing for Ken Marino. Ken Marino. Once again, you have to name for maximum points the show he's been in less than 30 times, closest to 30 without hitting 30 or going over.
Okay. Party Down.
Party Down is worth 3 points. It is not our number one answer. He's in 26 episodes of Party Down. I will let you know there's another show that he also was in 26 episodes of.
Hmm.
All right, to Sarah D. Bunting, what is your guess here?
Oh my God, so many to choose from. I don't think it's going to be that many, but let's try Veronica Mars.
Veronica Mars will get you 2 points. That is in the 10 to 19 bucket for 13 mm-hmm. episodes of Veronica Mars. All right, Allison, the number one is still on the board. You can get 5 points if you name it.
I'm going to fly close to the sun and guess the other two.
The other two is worth...
No!
30 episodes. 30.
Oh,
so
on the dot? Oh, that's a heartbreaker.
I thought there might be a couple he sat out. Damn.
Yeah, that was my thinking, is I think the show's 30 episodes, but he's like not mm-hmm. that big
he's
of a character.
He's 28 or something.
But
yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's heartbreaking.
The State was our number one answer.
Oh.
The State.
Oh, sure. Right.
27 episodes. All right, let's move on to Sarah D. Bunting to start us off with Wendy Malick. Wendy Malick.
Gosh, that seems rude to Tara that I'm starting there.
She was in three shows a lot.
Mm-hmm.
She was in three shows a lot.
Yeah, don't name
let's
any of those.
Try, ooh, how long was that on? Hot in Cleveland?
Hot in Cleveland was one of those three shows. Over. 125 episodes of Hot in Cleveland.
Really?
Yep.
Good for Cleveland.
No
good
points for you either. All right, Allison, Wendy Malick.
I'm going to leave some money on the table here and go with a sure thing and say Shrinking.
Shrinking is worth... Oh, you got 2 points for Shrinking.
Nice.
It is in the 10 to 19 bucket, 12 episodes. All right, Tara, number one answer still on the board.
I know. But this is a number two answer, and I'm going to take it anyway. The Chicken Sisters?
The Chicken Sisters is worth 2 points, 15 episodes.
Woo!
We had in our three-point bucket, Jake in Progress,
uh-huh.
and the reboot of Night Court.
Oh,
number
yeah, yeah,
one
yeah.
answer right. at 22 episodes, Young Sheldon.
Really?
Oh.
A show you all watch, Young Sheldon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Allison, start us off with Adam Scott. Adam Scott.
I mean, am I allowed to reuse a show that's already come yep. up in the conversation? Mm-hmm. Then I will say Party Down.
Party Down is our number one answer.
Nice.
5 points. 26 episodes. Squeaking in. Tara.
Severance?
Severance is our number two answer at the three-point level. 20 episodes just sneaking into that bucket. Sarah D. Bunting. Best answer you can give will get you 2 points at this point.
Another Veronica Mars grad, but he was only on the one. I don't even know. Parks and Rec?
Parks and Rec. Way too many Parks and Rec. 96 yeah. episodes of that.
Luke?
At least he was actually on that show.
Your two-point answers were Ghosted, if you remember that one. Big Little Lies and Tell Me You Love Me.
Oh, yeah.
With the Good thing. Place.
Ew, that good. Thing.
The Good Place is 5 episodes, so that was the number one.
That
was a one-point answer. Tara, start us off with Andrea Martin.
Okay, Difficult People.
Difficult People is our number one answer. Woo! 26 episodes. Number one answer off the board. Sarah.
Honestly, I don't know who that is, so I'm going to say Rescue
Andrea
Me.
Andrea Martin?
You know who Andrea Martin is from SCTV.
I don't. Rescue Me is my answer.
You've seen her in Only Murders. She's in that.
Oh,
and
okay.
And My Big Fat Greek Wedding. She ate her twin in the womb.
Yes.
Did not watch that movie. Do not know who that person is. Rescue Me is my answer. Thank you.
Allison.
Evil.
Evil. Pure evil. Oh, 30 episodes of evil.
No! Again?
You're getting a special prize for naming the 30 episode answers.
All right,
for
I'll
sure.
take it.
Number two answer would have been Great News. Great News.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, start us off with Titus Willeber.
Oh, no. Besides Bosch, and of course that one glorious episode of Beverly Hills 90210.
Of course.
Was he on Sons of Anarchy?
Was he on Sons of Anarchy? The answer is yes. He was on 12 episodes for 2 points. Allison, number one answer on the board. Number two answer on the board.
I think this is going to be very under, but he was on Deadwood, right?
Deadwood is our
Shit.
Number one answer.
That's what I was
he
say.
Was in 27 nice. Episodes of Deadwood, so he's in quite a few.
Ooh.
Wow, I'm really going all or nothing in this game.
Tara.
Ballard?
Ballard is good for 1 point.
Okay,
he was in
I'll
three episodes. Bosch Original 68, Bosch Legacy 30. So that would have been an Allison answer. All right. Speaking of Allison, start us off with Lucy Lawless, or as I like to say, Loosely Lawless.
Loosely Lawless.
Because I don't know how to talk anymore. Lucy Lawless. Oh,
this is like a person where I only know her marquee thing that is definitely wrong. Yeah. And so I can't say that. And
but maybe you could think, if you're really desperate, go parallel.
He-Man? I don't know. This is
very close. Okay, no points, but when we reveal, you'll see how close you were. All right, yes.
I'm going to leave that one on the board and say Parks and Recreation for her.
Parks and Rec, good for 2 points, 10 episodes. Do you know who Lucy Lawless is, Sarah? She was also on SCTV.
I also know Lucy Lawless. Hercules, The Legendary Journeys, or whatever it was called.
That was the one that we were trying to get Allison towards. That is the... Also in the same universe as Xenowar Princess, which I assume is what you were thinking of. That is worth 1.8 episodes. Number one answer, 29 episodes. Perfect answer. Ash versus Evil Dead.
There were 30 episodes of that thing?
29 episodes, yeah. Battlestar Galactica, 16. Parks and Rec, 10. Yeah. Salem, 15.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Battlestar.
Tara, start us off with Daikin Lockman. Feel free to search that. If you don't know who that is, you'll know her face for sure.
How do you spell that?
D-I-C-H-E-N-L-A-C-H-M-A-N. Daikin Lockman.
Oh, yes.
All right. Okay. Tara, start us off. Daikin Lockman.
Dollhouse?
Dollhouse is our number one answer. 27 Ooh. Episodes. Nicely done. Sarah D. Bunting.
The Last Ship?
The Last Ship
is... wait. Yeah, it's The Last Ship.
Last Ship is worth 1 point. Nice. Episodes. All right. Allison, got an answer here.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the easy one and say Severance.
Severance is our second best answer. That is worth 3 points, 20 episodes of that. Sarah D. Bunting, 23 episodes of Animal Kingdom. Isn't that a show that you...
Oh, yeah.
13 totally episodes of my favorite fruit-based diplomacy submarine show, Last Resort.
She was in Last Resort and Last Ship? Damn.
And Last Ship. God damn. I was thinking of Last Resort. Yeah. Shit.
Doesn't matter. She was in both.
103 episodes of Neighbors. So I'm glad nobody answered that.
Yes.
Sarah D. Bunting, Zahn McLarnon. Sarah D. Bunting starts off Zahn McLarnon. Feel free to look that one up, too.
Thank you.
Don't know the face. You'll know him as soon as you see him.
Oh, right. Okay. The obvious one. It's not going to work.
It might.
It might. And I can't pull the other one with that guy with the nose. So let's try Reservation Dogs.
2 points for 12 episodes of Reservation Dogs where he played the sheriff or tribal police.
Tribal cop.
To Allison.
I'm going to play it safe because I don't remember the episode order of the obvious one. And so I'm going to say Westworld.
Westworld is good for 1 point. He was in 8 episodes of Westworld. Tara, we still got number one and number two shows.
Yeah, I guess this, I mean, I'm gonna, what the hell? Dark Winds.
Dark Winds is good for 3 points. He was in 20 episodes of Dark Winds. Number one answer, 28 shows. Everybody's favorite dad show, Longmire.
Oh, yeah.
Allison.
And Dark Winds is the one I was thinking of.
Hugh Laurie, Allison.
Oh, God.
Avenue 5.
Avenue 5, good for 2 points, 17 episodes.
Authoritatively done.
Yep. Tara?
Veep?
Veep is good for 3 points, 20 episodes, just sneaking into the 20 to 29 bucket. Sarah?
Let's hope they hook this before 30. Chance.
Chance is also 3 points, also 20 episodes. We've got, at number one, A Bit of Fry and Laurie with 26 episodes from the UK. How many episodes of House do you think there were?
Oh, like 200?
355.
122?
176.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow. It's too many.
Tara.
Yep.
Annabeth Gish.
The Gisher.
The Gish. Gish, Gish, Gish.
Halt and Catch Fire.
Halt and Catch Fire is good for 2 points, 17 episodes. Sarah.
The X-Files.
X-Files, good answer.
Nice.
26 episodes, but yet only a 3-point answer. Still one above that.
I'm like blanking out because I was so fixated on Halt and Catch Fire. I didn't think of other shows that she's been in, even though I love her.
And I love her too.
And I can picture her face and her voice, but I'm having a very hard time coming up with alternatives.
She gets mixed up with Amy Brenneman a little bit.
Oh my God. This is very embarrassing. Let's see. I'm just going to take a stab. I'm also going to guess Parks and Rec is like a random backup, but I know it's wrong.
I love that answer. No, not on the list. Our number one answer was Brotherhood.
Oh, sure.
Number two answer left on the board, The Bridge.
All right.
She was in Sons of Anarchy.
Right. She was in Mayfair Witches, too, wasn't she?
Mayfair Witches, West Wing, Rizzoli and
Isles. That is what I was thinking of. Yeah. I reviewed Mayfair Witches.
All right. Here's one for the group. Sarah's going to start us off with Christine Baranski.
Oh, God.
Oh, sorry.
Best answer is going to be less than 30. Highest number, less than 30.
Okay. Well, then we have to cast our minds back to other things that she might have been on.
Stall artist good. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
It didn't have good in the title. God, what was the name of that thing? I can't remember the name of that program. So,
I will say, not a lot of choices here. She wasn't in a lot of
TV. Not a lot of choices. Okay.
She's a real all or nothing actor.
For that. Let's try her on Mom.
Mom.
That's a fair guess. You know who did do Mom? Wendy Malick.
Mm-hmm. All right. Allison.
Nine Perfect Strangers.
Nine Perfect Strangers. Good for 1 point. She was in 8 episodes of that. Tara.
The Big Bang Theory.
The Big Bang Theory is good for 2 points. She was in 16 episodes of that. She was in 25 episodes of, guys, The Gilded Age.
I wondered. For some reason, I thought it was over.
Damn it.
All right, this will take us to our score break. Allison, start us off with Bruce Greenwood. Bruce Greenwood.
That motherfucker.
Can I also look up those names?
Yes. Sure. He was Kennedy in 13 Days.
He's very generic man.
Yeah, oh, he is. Yes. That guy.
Yeah.
This
Canadian?
Is
Canada's own Bruce Greenwood. We claim him.
Mm-hmm.
Founded a cemetery. He did.
I'm going to let you know. Parks and Rec, not on the list.
Yes. I will also take a stab in the dark and say Mad Men.
He does have the look. I can see it.
Wait, what? What is a Mad Men?
Yes.
4 episodes of Mad Men. One point.
There we go.
Yes. Nicely done.
I was like, that's a white man who could be in an office.
He does have the look. That was impressive. That was great. All right, Tara.
The Fall of the House of Usher.
The Fall of the House of Usher. Oh, wait, that's a miniseries, maybe?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Guess again.
No, it's okay.
No, guess again.
Oh, God. Maybe he was in a previous one? Was he in Midnight Mass? No, wait, never mind. That's another miniseries. Okay.
There's one show here I'm stunned at. Never would have guessed he was in that.
Flashpoint.
Not on the list.
Stab in the dark.
Number one, number two answers still on the board. And 3 and 4.
Oh.
Everything right, but well, Mad Men still on the board.
Hope they didn't consider this a limited or mini series. American Crime Story.
2 points, 10 episodes. All right. Our second best answer of 22 episodes was Knott's Landing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Okay.
And I'm ashamed to say you guys weren't paying attention. 25 episodes of everybody's favorite show, Nowhere Man.
Right.
Just on the podcast a couple weeks ago.
I thought you were going to say The Shield.
Mm.
Oh, all right. God. We need the scores, please.
Okay. Sarah has 16. Allison has 20. I have 31.
Let's get right back into it. Tara starts off with Leslie Jordan.
American Horror Story.
American Horror Story is good for 2 points, 10 episodes. Sarah D. Bunting. Lots of shows I've never heard of at the top of this list.
Great.
Sarah D. Bunting. Leslie Jordan.
No way. Uh-huh.
It's your turn to guess. Now.
Yes, it is. American Crime Story.
American Crime Story.
Yep.
Allison, San Diego's own Allison, what do you got?
I'm going to complete the trifecta. That's also the first time anyone's ever called me that. complete the Ryan Murphy trifecta and say the politician.
Politician. No, not on the list. Number one answer, Hearts Afire.
Okay.
Number two answer, The Cool Kids.
Oh, yeah, right. That thing.
2 points if you said Will and Grace, the only show I know him from. And others. Lois and Clark, two episodes.
Sure.
Niecy Nash.
Oh, God.
Oh, boy. Okay. Monster, colon, Dahmer, colon, the Milwaukee disaster, whatever it was called. Thank you.
Monster, 7. Good for 1 point. 2, Allison.
Moving On. That's the name of the show.
Getting On.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Am I allowed to?
2 points.
Okay.
18 episodes of Getting On.
I don't know if they counted this as a limited series. There's only been one season of it so far, but Grotesquery.
10 episodes for 2 points. Squeaking in to the 2 point bucket. Number one, Rookie, Feds.
Oh, yeah. Right.
The Rookie, Feds. Mm-hmm. Masters of Sex, Original Rookie, Bindi Project, Bernie Mac Show, all 1 point answers.
Oh, right.
Wendell Pierce, Allison. Wendell Pierce.
Oh, my God.
You're going to have to dig for the number one and number two answers here, people.
Yes. How many episodes did this have? I'm going to say, I'm not going to guess it because you said I'd have to dig. Or maybe, I don't know. How many episodes did Treme have?
Treme is your answer?
Yes.
36 okay. episodes.
Ooh.
Tara.
Oh, no. It's probably over two, but I have to say The Wire.
The Wire, 60 episodes.
60? He was in that many? Damn.
Yeah. Everything's on the board, Sarah Debunting.
Michael J. Fox Show.
Michael J. Fox Show is our number one answer.
Good job.
22 episodes, followed right behind with The Gregory Hines Show with 21 episodes. Power, Book 3, Raising Kanan. Ray Donovan, 11 episodes. Tara, Terry O'Quinn, 2 5-point answers here.
Okay. Alias?
Alias is one of them. 5 points.
Great.
Sarah.
How soon did they kill him off is the question. Not soon enough. Oh, my God. There was like a mustache and a wig. I'm almost positive. Murder One.
There's a mustache and a wig. No, Murder One, not on the list. Allison. Terry O'Quinn, famous wig and mustache haver.
Yeah, truly like a person where I draw a blank after the top thing on his call sheet. So yeah. I'm just going to guess another Damon Lindelof show that I know is wrong, but we're just going to honor the connection and say The Leftovers.
The Leftovers, that is a decent guess, but not on the list. Of course, Lost is that 122% episode. Yeah. Millennium also over at 41. The other number one answer was Patriot.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Other notables, 666 Park Avenue. Blacklist Redemption. I didn't even know there was a Blacklist spinoff.
Right.
Also in the West Wing. The West Wing's become a reliable maybe answer here. And of course, 6 episodes of everybody's secondary Earth show, Earth 2. Sarah Debunting, this is question 17, getting towards the end of the game.
It's pretty cool.
Okay, it's pretty cool.
Keith David.
Not David.
David Keith.
I understand.
2 5-point answers as well on this one.
Oh. I don't think I can guess the... All right, I'm going to just be safe and say Enlisted.
5 points.
Damn it.
13 episodes. Sharing with what, though? Allison, can you guess the other show? 13 episodes.
I'm also going to be safe and just say The Lowdown.
The Lowdown. He is in 8 episodes. I don't know if they all aired, but we're going to call it 8. Was it all shows at once release?
No.
No, it's rolling out?
No.
Well, whatever. It's been more than one episode, so it's going to be a 1 point answer either way.
Okay.
Tara.
I really was counting on Enlisted a lot. Duster, I guess.
Duster is also 8 episodes, so that is another 1 point answer. Can anybody guess the one show that he's been in more than 30 times?
I was really bummed that we couldn't say animated voice acting because he's in Has Been Hotel, one of the weirdest shows I've ever reviewed. Yeah.
Has anybody heard of Greenleaf?
No. Vaguely?
Okay.
Is that on
Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, 9 episodes.
Okay.
The Cape, guys, the Cape. Mm-hmm. But the number one answer, sharing with enlisted community, 13 episodes as well. Mm. Allison, right. Start us off.
I was right. It is an Oprah show.
Betty White.
Oh. Are we allowed to do, because you can't do a single appearance, but you can do multiple appearances. So SNL?
SNL. Not on the list. You want to look that up quickly, though, Tara?
Sure. She was only in one episode and twice in specials.
That's a heartbreaker. I would have guessed that would have been correct. Tara.
Was she in more than... I think she was probably in more than 30 of this, but I'm going to say it anyway. The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
45 episodes of that. All right. Everything's on the board, Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, God. I just thought of the perfect one. Damn it.
Golden Palace?
Yes,
number
that's it.
One answer for 5 points, 24 episodes. Followed close behind for 3 points if you said The Bold and the Beautiful.
Good job, Sarah.
All right, this is question 19. Tara, Will Arnett, what hasn't he been in?
Seriously. Oh, man. What was that show he was in with Carrie Russell and Peter Serafinowicz? Oh, yeah. I don't remember what it was called.
I do because I have the answer here.
Oh, great. Oh, he was in that divorce show too. I'm just gonna have to say Lego Masters. I can't think of the names of those other two shows. Right. It's more than 32. Also, yeah.
All right, Sarah.
Maybe he was in whatever it was actually called for TV, Wet Hot American Summer. Seriously.
All right, everything's on the board, Allison.
I do have a backup answer, but can I just ask if Twisted Metal counts?
No, because it's just voice.
Yeah. Then in that case, I will just say The Morning Show.
The Morning Show, 4 episodes worth 1 point.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Sarah D. Bunting, for 2 episodes, you could have guessed The Sopranos.
He was in 2 episodes of The Sopranos? Apparently. Wow.
Okay.
Maybe the Hollywood stuff? Sure. I don't know.
Maybe.
Running Wild was the show you were
thinking
of.
Running Wild.
Number one answer. Anybody want to guess if I say it's a really long title?
Oh, it's not the really long title, but what was the Venice Beach divorce show called? Is it Flaked?
Flaked. 14 episodes. Okay. Riviera, 10. 9 episodes of 30 Rock Great Dogs Like This.
Of course.
Oh, sure.
The Increasingly Poor Decisions of Todd Margaret. 20 episodes. Right. All right. 2 more questions left. Sarah D. Bunting, start us off with Jerry Ryan.
I can picture the outfit, and it's eluding me. Hmm. This is wrong, but let's try it. Revenge.
Allison, Jerry Ryan.
This is not a field in which I have much to contribute.
It's not part of your ministry?
Yeah, no.
Before you guess, not in Parks and Rec. Nor West Wing, because I led you down that path.
Double in.
Seems like an oversight. Sopranos?
Other space show, Battlestar Galactica.
Picard is the number one answer. You're so close, Allison. Nice. Star Trek Picard, 25 episodes. Next one is Sarah D. Bunting. Bosch, 12 episodes.
Yeah. God, that was a long time ago.
She seems like someone who was like a Charlie love interest on 2 and a Half Men for like 5 episodes.
It does kind of feel like that. 3 episodes, yeah. Sarah D. Bunting, Law and Order, SVU. Mm. 2 episodes of Melrose Place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Last one, Allison. Victor Garber. Canada's own Victor
Sarah,
Garber.
Sarah, look him up. Remind yourself.
This is leaving stuff on the board, but I have to say, because he was just in the finale and just like that.
And just like that, 1 point for 5 episodes.
He shared the screen with poop in the series finale.
He needs to be memorialized.
I don't know what that means, but I don't want to know. Tara.
I'll tell you. What was he in some of? One wonders. Oh my God, what was the name of that show? The negotiation show that Sarah made us watch. The lawyer show with Kerr Smith.
I'm looking at the list and it's not jogging my memory.
I also don't remember the name of it.
negotiation? I don't remember what it was
called. It was named something completely vague and broad, like law.
We'll have to find out after Sarah's answer, because I don't see anything that's dark in my memory, and there's nothing called a negotiator or anything like
that. It's not. It wasn't that.
Sarah, obviously lots of stuff stolen aboard.
Tales of the City?
Tales of the City is also a one-point answer. Nice. 7 episodes. All right, let's figure out what we're talking about. I know it's not Eli Stone. Mm-mm. That was our number 5, or that was our 5-point answer. 26 episodes. Web Therapy, 21 episodes. Mm. All right, here are your 2-point answers. Mm-hmm. Power, The Mm-mm. Orville, Mm-mm. Justice, Mm-mm. The Flash.
That's it, Justice. That's why we can remember it.
All right.
Terrible Power. Title.
The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd.
Oh.
Keeps
cutting that up.
Power Book 2, Ghost.
Gosh.
Our second Power Book. The series about Mac laptops. All right, let's find out our final regulation scores, please.
Our final scores are Allison with 25, Sarah with 33, me with 46.
All right, nicely done. So today belongs to Sarah. Nope. Today belongs...
Nope.
Nope, I know who you are. Today belongs to Tara.
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 Good job.
Thank you, Mike, once again for that.
I don't know that name.
Format. All right, guys, that is it for this episode of Extra Hot Great. We sat down to discuss the Tim Robinson series, The Chair Company, before going around the dial with stops at 911 Original Rays, 911 Hot Chicken, Devil in Disguise, and The Alabama Solution. Tara's secret skill, getting Platonic into the canon, did not make an appearance today. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was a winner of this week's Game Time from Mike. Next up, it's DMV on Extra, Extra Hot Great. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
In The Chair Company, Tim Robinson plays Ron Trosper, and in Justice, Victor Garber played Ron Trott. How high does this go?
Sarah D. Bunting.
You gave me that paper too hard.
And Allison Herman.
I'm gunning for TECA Employee of the Month.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
I can name all of the prime numbers to 1,000. Do you want to see it? Yeah. 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, 23.
We believe.
23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23. 23.